Black and white archive photographs of people wrapped up in blankets or wearing striped uniforms behind a wire fence. January 27th, 1945. The Auschwitz concentration and extermination camp is liberated by the Soviet army. There, they discover the largest mass murder in history.
Those who survived could answer the roll call of all the nations of Europe. They had been beaten down to live like animals. Far worse, for few animals had lived in the terror, hunger, and filth of these victims. People who once had been human beings, like you and me.
Who would even suspect it in the 20th century of such a thing that it can be done? The things that the Nazis did, Auschwitz, I say the Satan would have been envious.
In Auschwitz, the Nazis create a mass killing machine that runs to its own relentless rhythm. In this hell, there is music. In a field of long grass by the camp perimeter, people dressed in black are setting up four chairs and music stands. Auschwitz has multiple orchestras. All the performers are prisoners. A black and white image of the orchestra performing by a barn in the concentration camp. This is the story of four musicians sent to the camp, told in their own words, how they used music to survive and resist. Another black and white photo of a huge orchestra, then an old white woman with short white hair sitting in an armchair.
Well, that crazy band as we were, we survived. I mean, the moment they don't want music, we go in the gas chambers.
The stone walls inside the gas chambers.
And I'm now, I think, the last person left who was there.
Resting her palm on her cheek, she stares off into the distance gravely. The last musician of Auschwitz. The woman, Anita Lasker-Wolfish, is smoking a cigarette in her armchair. April 1945, BBC Radio interviews a 19-year-old Auschwitz survivor. A photo of teenage Anita, who's slim with brown hair. This is Anita Lasker, a German Jew, speaking. First, I would like to say a few words about Auschwitz. The few who have survived are afraid that the world will not believe what happened there. There, living, healthy people were thrown alive into the fire. I've seen everything with my own eyes. At night, the fire burned all the way to the sky. Music was played alongside it. I myself was in the orchestra. Music was played to the most terrible things. Closing in on a map displaying the Polish-occupied territory annexed by the Third Reich in the west of Poland. A dot on the map labelling Auschwitz near Krakow. During the 5 years of the camp's operation, the Nazis transport 1.3 million people to Auschwitz. 1.1 million are systematically murdered. Four people dressed in black, carrying instrument cases, are walking towards the main gates of Auschwitz II, Birkenau.
We were walked to Auschwitz. Suddenly, I thought I'm hallucinating because I heard eine kleine Nachtmusik from Mozart.
The quartet play the music at night. Various interviews with survivors.
They had such nerve. We were greeted by a band.
There was a band playing, the finest musicians in the world. These were all prisoners from all over occupied Europe.
It was an orchestra playing. So we thought, they cannot be that bad if they have concerts here.
I say, an orchestra here? I say, who needs music here? I say, I mean, they're crazy.
There is music. That threw me. I mean, what's going on here? It's really enough to make you lose your sanity.
I sometimes think of this as being very strange, to have fine music play in a death factory.
The quartet are playing on the concrete road in front of the main gate. Raphael Wallfisch, son of Anita Lasker Wallfisch.
When people find out that music was being made in Auschwitz, it is a shocking realization that music and the extermination of human beings can be connected in any way at all. That it's something that I knew about because my mere existence is thanks to my mother's survival, because she played the cello and was in the women's orchestra.
Before. Shaky archive footage of a bustling city with a huge Gothic-style building in a main square. On a map, a line from Auschwitz crosses the border of occupied Poland and Germany and ends in Breslau in the southeast of Germany. From the memoir of Anita Lasker Wallfisch.
My father was a lawyer of some repute.
A reenactment.
And my mother, apart from being very beautiful, had many accomplishments.
Sheet music.
But most important, she was a fine violinist. She would usually begin her practicing routine with the opening octaves of the Beethoven concerto.
It was a lovely, lovely childhood. My mother was a very good violinist, and it was normal that there was new music. You know, that was pre-television and all that. You can see in one of the photographs, I was sat on the floor with a broomstick and a comb, and my parents saw this child looks as if she wants to play the cello, so they bought me a cello.
Young Anita's mum places food on the table.
Life was pretty good. And it seemed inconceivable that it should not go on like that forever. I suppose ours was a typical middle-class assimilated Jewish family.
Make sure that you hear the second note.
A man plays cello for older Anita.
In the first years of the 20th century, Jewish life existed across Europe. But to be Jewish in Germany was the best place to be a Jew. They were successful, they were established, and kind of marker of their admission into German life was music. They had made a contribution in the form of Mendelssohn or Mahler. They would be in the audience at the opera houses and concert halls. They were embracing high culture, art, and all of it quintessentially German. It was a very core part of their identity.
Jewish, not Jewish didn't seem to be a problem in those days. We had a Christmas tree and we had Hanukkah, a menorah. It was normal, but one had no idea what was going to follow.
Archive footage of Nazis waving swastika flags. Jonathan Friedland.
Once the Nazis had seized power in 1933, they moved in increments to isolate Jews into ever narrower parts of social life.
A soldier does a Nazi salute. The actor playing young Anita.
Children would spit at me in the street and call me a dirty Jew.
Since we had been scarcely aware of our Jewishness at home, I found this all very bewildering and was full of envy for those people who did not have this mysterious stigma.
Jonathan.
There were laws passed against what they would have seen as racial mingling. There were travel restrictions. Jews couldn't own businesses. They couldn't own property. They were evicted from their homes. As time would go on, they had to be distinguished from the rest of the population and forced to wear the notorious yellow star. They were squeezed out of German life, stage by stage.
Older Anita.
Suddenly, everything got restricted. Not allowed to sit on a bench in a park, and, you know. It was an atmosphere of fear, suddenly.
A stone bridge crossing a river, then a line travelling across the border of Poland and towards Prague and what was then Czechoslovakia. A photo of a young white woman with short, dark hair. Ilse Weber, songwriter.
Over here, a storm is gathering.
Writing a letter.
We listen to your news, because ours is dictated and false.
She turns off the radio.
It looks very much like there is going to be war. And as though our children won't be able to reach a safe haven. Nothing but swastikas everywhere. It's like dancing on a powder keg.
Ulrika Migdal, author and historian.
Ilse was a multi-talented, cosmopolitan young woman. She wrote poems and short stories, but the most important interest focused on music. She had two children, Hanush and Tommy. And the letters throw a blunt light on the antisemitism and Nazi terror that increasingly poisoned the Jews' life in Czechoslovakia.
The worst is for us Jews. How Hitler must fear us that he persecutes us so.
Germany had been defeated in the First World War. The country was on its knees financially, and a myth developed that Germany had been the victim of the so-called stab in the back. And along comes the Nazis with a narrative which says the people to blame for bringing mighty Germany to its knees are the Jews. I mean, you can see here on the cover of Der Stürmer, Nazi propaganda paper, hideously caricatured Jews. The Nazism uses all that to advance its theory that there is a racial war going on, pitting Aryans against Jews, and that only one of these two races can win.
The actor playing Ilse.
Up to this day, I have believed in God. But if he doesn't give us a token of his existence soon, I can no longer. This persecution of Jews is inhuman. What should we do? Where should we go?
Ulrika.
In this desperate situation, Ilse heard about a rescue operation that was planned by an English stockbroker, Mr. Nicholas Winton, for 669 children. And Hanush was one of them.
Some Mr. Winton in London is running a children's transport. So my older boy is going to England. Perhaps for a long time. It won't be easy for us to part from him. But nevertheless, we'll be happy when he gets away from the bad atmosphere here.
Hugging a teddy.
When she put Hanush on the train, she was a desperate mother, being aware that she might not meet her son again. She had to send him away to save his life. But music gave her the strength to survive without him.
A train full of young children takes off along the tracks. Ilse writes a song about the pain of missing Hanush. After the war, it is at least 50 years before it's sung again. And the rain runs. Lyrics Ilse Weber. A young woman stands by a window and looks out at pouring rain.
Und der Regen rinnt, und der Regen rinnt. Ich denk im Dunkeln an dich, mein Kind. Hoch sind die Berge.
High are the mountains, deep is the sea. My weary heart yearns for you. And the rain runs, and the rain runs. Why are you far away, my child? And the rain runs, and the rain runs. God himself has separated us, my child.
Du sollst nicht Leid und Elend sehen.
You are not to see pain and suffering, not to walk on stony streets. Have you not forgotten me, my child? Throughout the song, black and white footage of children getting off a bus and carrying suitcases through a gate. Big Ben and the words war, movie tone news.
War. Precisely at dawn on September 1st, without warning, the German Wehrmacht rolled over the Polish border.
Soldiers traveling along a dirt road on motorbikes. The Nazis forced Jews in occupied countries into ghettos. 2 years into the war, deportations begin to a network of concentration camps across Europe. Archive footage of men lifting a limp body. In black and white footage, solemn-looking people wearing armbands walk in a group, then climb into a train carriage. Soldiers carrying weapons slide the train carriage door shut and lock it. In a reconstruction, young Anita sits at a table.
The deportations began, and my sister and I were determined not to wait till somebody comes and takes me away in order to kill me. We said we were going to run away.
A packed tram.
We were teenagers, and it was a crazy idea. We got ourselves false papers and tried to get to the unoccupied zone of France, but we didn't get there. We were arrested already at the station. And then my big odyssey started in prison, and I was very lucky to be in prison. It's much better to be in prison than to be in a concentration camp. And it took about a year before that court case came up. But as soon as the sentences were announced, the Gestapo came up again. And we were sent separately to Auschwitz. Auschwitz was notorious.
There were all sorts of rumours about the conditions of the camps, and especially about Auschwitz and the gas chambers. I now had to come to terms with the bitter truth that this was precisely what was ahead of me. It would be dishonest of me to say that I was not scared. But in an odd way, one can become so accustomed to being scared that it becomes part of one's makeup. We had lived in fear for so many years that it had merely become part of the background. And now, I was being confronted with the real thing.
Footage of a train moving along tracks and young Anita looking nervous. The word arrival appears in white between bars of music. Soaring over rows of long buildings surrounded by snow in the concentration camp, Auschwitz covers a 15-square-mile network of sub-camps. The largest is Auschwitz II, Birkenau. The straight train line leading to the main gate.
At this point, the overwhelming majority of Jews who arrived in Auschwitz believed they were going to form a new community together. That is why they had brought with them suitcases, pots, pans. They believed that this was some kind of fresh start.
They took all our luggage right away. And they make us give all our jewelry.
Every murder mill had its storage room. Each contained jewelry, watches, wedding rings.
peeps of eyeglasses.
A watchtower by a perimeter fence around the camp in the evening.
We arrived at Auschwitz-Birkenau in the evening. I don't know what time it was, but it was dark.
Young Anita.
When I try to recall my first impressions of Auschwitz, what comes to mind are black figures in capes, dogs barking and a great deal of shouting. We were taken to a barracks and there we had to wait.
I was not aware that I had already passed the first hurdle. Selection.
A trainload of Jews would arrive, and there and then, on the railway platform, they would be selected. To the left, you would be sent immediately to the gas chambers, but if you had chosen to go to the right, that meant you were of an age and a level of fitness where you might be useful as a worker.
Flying over the camp.
At the first light of day, we were taken to a different block. There, the welcoming ceremony took place.
Another survivor.
We were naive young people. I wouldn't have taken my clothes off in front of my mother. And we're ordered to take our clothes off. Everything.
They shaved our hair. Everything was shaven off.
The death mills were made to pay in many ways. Thousands of garments were stripped from prison. Human hair, women's hair, methodically packed, it was ready for sale to manufacturers.
Tattooed numbers on arms.
Another crew came in and put numbers on our arm.
At that moment, my name and my life became a number.
First thing I had removed when I came to the United States, right there.
I felt this was the last stripping away of my identity.
Sitting in her chair, older Anita rubs her face.
In the space of a few minutes, I had been stripped of every vestige of human dignity and become indistinguishable from everyone else around me.
There is a sort of welcoming ceremony, and all this is done by prisoners. We started this conversation, and she asked me, what did you do before the war? I said, I used to play the cello. Then she immediately said, there's an orchestra here, they need a cellist, and stay here. And so she went to find the conductor.
The last thing I had imagined when going to Auschwitz is that I would ever have a conversation about playing the cello.
Here I was stark naked, and she was asking me, who did you study with? It was somehow rather incongruous.
I heard the words, you will be saved. She said someone would come for me and I would have an audition.
I wasn't exactly on top form, but it was good enough. They didn't have a bass instrument. They were very happy to have me.
She looks off into the distance gravely. Barbed wire fences and a sign over the gate beside a watchtower. The Nazis set up 15 orchestras across the Auschwitz camp complex. Many of the first orchestra members were Polish political prisoners. A photo of a white man with balding dark hair, Adam Kopaczynski, conductor.
My name is Adam Kopaczynski.
The actor playing Adam walks into a room.
On the 6th of January 1942, I was transported to Auschwitz. I became a member of the orchestra, and then the conductor. The high-voltage perimeter fence, cutting us off from the outside world, marked the boundary of our existence. Cast out beyond the margins of society, we were able to create a new world. Those who inhabited this bizarre world, who wanted to live and vegetate within those narrow confines, had to forget about freedom and attempt to create at least the semblance of a normal life. And the things you could find there. By the end of the second year of the camp's operations, there'd be beautiful music and fine performances from first-rate vocal artists for residents to enjoy. Just a few days before they forfeited their life.
In black, the word work amongst scattered and overlapping musical notes. Soaring towards the Arbeit Macht Frei sign above the gate in the empty camp.
There's a big, huge gate with the sign up on top. Arbeit Macht Frei. Work will make you free.
Jonathan.
For the Nazis, there were two projects. One was a final solution to the persistent, stubborn presence of Jews in the world, which was their wholesale elimination and murder. But another was to turn the Third Reich into an economic superpower.
Footage of factories.
They envisaged Auschwitz and the area around it as an industrial hub. They invited the big industrial giants, IG Farben and Siemens, to build big factories there. But there would be one advantage, the advantage that all empires have had for thousands of years, namely slave labor.
Photos of prisoners working in factories.
Part of the process was to drill them with almost military-like efficiency. And so these working units would leave the camp at dawn each morning, and to accompany them, there would be music.
What they wanted the orchestra to play were marches. We had sheet music for over 100. They filled up two closets which stood in the music room in Block 24.
In an archive at the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, a man pulls out a fence full of art by former prisoners. One piece of art shows people with shaved heads playing string instruments.
It played out of doors, even in temperatures down to -5 degrees centigrade. Pain forcing tears from our eyes.
The fence around the perimeter. Now, Anita.
Well, we had to play marches every morning and every evening because Auschwitz surrounded with factories and people should march nicely in step. So we had to sit by the gate and play marches for about an hour or so till everybody was out, and the same thing in the evening on the way back. But we were scared stiff to play wrong notes. It was just better to be scared stiff than to look out of the window and see the smoking chimneys.
A drawing of prisoners carrying bodies.
There were tens of thousands of prisoners who were working as slaves. Their life expectancy was rarely more than 2 or 3 months, and it became this kind of black hole in the heart of Nazi-occupied Poland into which Jews from all over Europe were disappearing.
A black mark spreads across Auschwitz on a map of occupied Poland. A man typing on a typewriter. A black and white photo of composer Simon Lax. He's a white man with round glasses and is wearing a tall hat.
Auschwitz was a certain kind of negative world to which we were abducted. White became black and black white. Values were turned around 180 degrees.
My father, he was Jewish and was very musical, and so ended up in Paris, which was the great place where artists concentrated.
Andrei Lax, son of Simon Lax. While the black mark spreads out further from Auschwitz across occupied Europe, a black line stretches from Auschwitz to Paris.
Then came the war with the German invasion of France. He was arrested, and then he was deported to Auschwitz.
The actor portraying Simon has dark hair and glasses.
The first questions I asked myself were, what kind of a world is this? What sort of creatures are those zebra-like beings with shaved heads swaying on their feet, emaciated like skeletons? I tried to shake off this nightmare, to tell myself that it was a dream, but an awakening did not come.
Andre's reading.
My father doesn't extend on what he described as the horror. Well, there is one sentence, it's indescribable, and so I won't describe it. But the horror is there.
Remember every day marching out to work, and there was this orchestra playing. But I remember
How ironical it was.
We left the camp every day with the soldiers and the Tommy guns and the dogs. And we built a road that somehow it seemed to me was going to nowhere.
The work group that I was part of went out every day with a strength of 600, only half of whom returned to the camp in the evening on their own two legs. It consisted of loading a sort of wheelbarrow with earth. It was carried by two people and emptied 100 meters away. Now imagine, if you can, that we had to run all day long under an uninterrupted hail of blows. Unbelievable as it may seem, after 20 days of this work, I was still alive.
Who can do this job with no food in their stomach? Every time we see them coming back, they were holding three dead people.
A drawing of prisoners holding an emaciated man's body.
In Auschwitz, we had a collection of the greatest musicians entertain us as we were walking out the gate to work and when we were coming back. Now, who the heck, we needed entertainment? We needed food. I cannot explain it any other way but sadism.
The Nazis think of themselves as a race of cultured supermen. For them, music holds a special power.
German nationalism, in its Nazi form, took as read that German culture was the highest form of culture. Just as they believed the greatest literature ever written was by Goethe, they would insist that the greatest music ever written was by Beethoven or Bach. Germany and Germans were better than everyone else. There was a movement against degenerate art, so-called, and as part of that, the music of Jews, composers long dead, was banned, so you would not be able to hear the music of Mendelssohn or Mahler in a concert hall in Nazi Germany, because the sound of a Jew was to become forbidden, even if that Jew was long in the ground.
In Hitler's Germany, the music of any Jewish composer is outlawed. Masterpieces the world has loved are confiscated as unfit for Nazi ears.
Joseph Goebbels says youth concerts, the Hitler Youth are making efforts in the war through its young artistic talent. Delight in our concerts of our young creatives as they strengthen the homeland through the works of great masters. A fair-haired young man plays piano. Goebbels continues, the objection often raised against us in the past, that there was no way to eliminate Jews from art and cultural life, because there were too many of them and we could not fill the empty places, has been brilliantly refuted. Artists in Germany have never been as awesome, and the arts as sought after and respected as they are today. The young man finishes playing, and an audience applauds. Barbed wire around the brick buildings in the concentration camp. Even in Auschwitz, the Nazis demand musical entertainment. Anita.
Apart from our twice daily outings to the camp gate to play marches for the outgoing and incoming commandos, we had other functions. We gave concerts most Sundays. We also had to be ready to play for any SS personnel who came into our block for some light relief after selecting who should live and who should die.
Raphael plays a cello in the woods. Troy Murray dreams Robert Schumann. The sun glinting through the canopy of leaves above.
During the internment of my mother, Josef Mengele, the infamous doctor who uses qualifications for experimentation on inmates. For his light entertainment, he entered the barrack where my mother was and requested a performance of Träumerei, part of Schumann's beautiful Kindersehnen, which depicts idyllic scenes of childhood.
Young children playing in a garden.
A great irony, considering what was happening around and what he was busy doing. So it's a very poignant moment for me to play the same music.
The children run across the grass, grinning. Anita.
They could come in any time to ask for a nice tune. Well, Mengele came in, he wanted to hear the Träumerei by Schumann, and it was my repertoire, so I played the Träumerei by Schumann.
A little girl with a serious expression brushes back her dark hair.
People asked me, how did you feel? I said, I didn't feel anything. I played it as fast as possible. I said, get out.
Raphael closes his eyes.
This kind of classical music was the lifeblood of the German people. But there are many examples of these very cultured people doing the worst atrocities ever known to humankind.
Soaring over dense trees, Simon Lax.
There really is no doubt that the Germans are music lovers from birth. Their insistence on having music at a place like Auschwitz is only one example of this passion. How could people who love music to this extent, people who could cry when they hear it, be at the same time capable of committing so many atrocities on the rest of humanity?
Andre.
It's just an extremely striking paradox, which implies that culture does not protect one from being a beast.
Survival. The actor playing Adam Kopaczynski.
No one has any idea how difficult it is to write about Auschwitz without being misunderstood, especially when it comes to a discipline of the arts such as music, which in the eyes of most, sadly, always has been a sort of entertainment. So for many people, it will seem strange that music helped to fulfill such an important role. After all, for us musicians, it is our livelihood, but we need it to live. But in this particular situation, we needed it to survive.
Rows of wooden bunks in a block. Simon.
One evening, like every evening, I was lying on my pallet wondering how much longer I would last when the barracks chief called out, "Is there someone here who speaks Polish and plays bridge?" A few minutes later, dirty, unshaven, not believing my eyes and ears, I was sitting at a bridge table in the private room of the barracks chief, in the company of two other VIPs in striped clothing, playing like an equal with equals. During one of the hands, I managed to mutter to him that I was a violinist and composer. He looked at me with a bitter, honest reproach. "Why didn't you tell me this sooner? Tomorrow you'll stay in the barracks and I'll take you over to the orchestra." A second companion added, choking with laughter, "And if you're accepted, maybe you'll live a little longer."
Andre, a white man in his 70s with grey hair and glasses.
My father has abilities as a real composer, and one day he's chosen as a director of one of the orchestra. Musicians had a better chance to survive, and being in the orchestra, that was what one would call a relatively safe place. Not really safe, but somewhat safer.
Andre sits at a table to look through photographs.
I have some picture after the war, sitting at the piano in this very apartment.
After the war, Simon Lax composes a piece reflecting on the horrors of Auschwitz.
If you are interested, actually, I could play it for you.
He sits at the piano. A photo of Simon playing. Funeral, Simon Lax.
In order to survive there, you had to compromise. Either you place yourself on the side of the torturers. The best example is the Jews that saved their own life by burning their companion Jews. Or you can compromise by accepting to be a musician and to be part of the Nazi politics against your will. The best way of describing it is the expression of Primo Levi, which speaks of a gray zone where moral values and so on are so shaken that it affects your own worldview. Music became a means of surviving. And my father was self-conscious about the way that he didn't have to suffer from hunger in a way that his companions couldn't.
Footage of older people piled into the three levels of the wooden bunks in a block.
If they wanted to punish you, today no food. As simple as that.
The starvation was just terrible. And hanging and beating, living in constant terror and fear for your life.
In the morning, some of them ran out of the barrack, and we could see them holding the electrical barbed wire in their hand. That's how they committed suicide.
I saw a girl died. She touched the electric wire.
You know, we don't feel sorry for her. We thought she's free already, you know. We thought she was lucky to die, you know.
Anita's words.
My experiences were, of course, different from those of the vast majority of prisoners, for the simple reason that I was lucky enough to be in the orchestra. I had not lost my identity totally. I may no longer have had a name, but I was identifiable. I was the cellist. It helped me to maintain a shred of human dignity. However, the background was the same for all of us. We must not forget that outside our little world, the gas chambers were working non-stop.
Simon.
One can get used to anything, to the most monstrous things. Habituation to everything that is going on around us. I personally believe that music was simply one of the parts of camp life, and that it stupefied the newcomer in the same way as everything he encountered in his first days in the camp. Music kept up the spirit, or rather the body, of only the musicians, who did not have to go out to hard labor, and who could eat a little better.
Some people thought it was, they could shut their eyes and listen to some music and dream themselves out of the situation they're in, and others find it offensive. And I can understand both. But nothing took you away from Auschwitz. You're in Auschwitz, you sit there, you're in Auschwitz. So for half an hour, you can think of something else.
Andre finishes playing.
It's very powerful. And I made some mistakes. But you have an idea of what it is.
He closes the piano lid. Flying over forests and fields, then a line leading down from Auschwitz on a map to Kelch in what was then Czechoslovakia. Jonathan Friedland, author and journalist.
The Nazis operated on a system of racial hierarchy. They, the Aryan race, the master race, was at the top, and Jews were at the very bottom. But there were other groups that they categorized as racially inferior. Among them were the Roma people, the Sinti people, people who Germans would call by their word for gypsies, that had their own cultures and traditions that the Germans deemed polluting of the purity of the German race. They too were victims of Nazism.
For my family, Auschwitz is primarily related to my maternal grandfather's family. Most of the people in that family who died, which was a lot of people, died at Auschwitz.
Petra Gilbert, granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, musicologist.
And he had this repeated phrase, until his death by suicide, which was, they burned my whole family, so let me be burned too, which is really significant because you do not get cremated if you're Romani. It's not a thing. And for him, it was a statement. You know, that's the memorial to the Holocaust. The term gypsy is a tricky one because it has all these negative connotations. But then most English-speaking Romani people refer to themselves as gypsies. You can't sort of will it out of existence. Before the war, there was enormous discrimination for hundreds of years. Around the 18th century, there were gypsy hunts, and you could just legally go and just hunt down and kill Romani people. So there wasn't this sort of nothing, 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 and then suddenly Hitler and Holocaust. It wasn't like that at all. It was a much kind of smoother transition. And then there was a decree made by Himmler. It was basically just everybody who's Romani in any way, shape, or form, half, quarter, whatever, like they're just all gonna die.
A camp perimeter.
The Gypsy family camp was situated right next to Mengele's lab. He was very interested in twins. And a lot of the images that people actually might recognize are actually Romani children. And we have unspeakably horrific testimony of these children who were just tortured alive.
Children in striped uniforms.
But it's impossible to imagine a group of Romari not singing. I mean, people absolutely would have been singing to their last breath, I think.
Prisoners in Auschwitz create music which records what is happening to them.
Auschwitz at the Hikerbaro, which means there's a big building in Auschwitz, is a song entirely in the Romani language. We don't know who originally wrote it. And I've tried to ask my grandmother, where did you first learn this? And she says, it was just in the family. It talks about the blackbird, which is a symbol of death. Then it talks about the hunger, you know, the beatings, and it has a very roundabout way of talking about rape. But it really is the best example of folk poetry that we have to give testimony.
Petra is standing outside by a barn on her farm. There's a big building in Auschwitz, Anon.
Auschwitz at the Hikerbaro.
There is a big building in Auschwitz. That's where my beloved sits.
Eide beshel beshel gondoline.
Oh, he sits and sits, contemplating and forgetting about me. A wind is blowing from Russia. My beloved is leaving me. He is leaving, leaving with a heavy heart, because I could not say goodbye. He says, oh, you little blackbird, take my letter. Take it to my wife to tell her that I'm in Auschwitz. There's great hunger in Auschwitz. There's nothing to eat, not a crust of bread. Footage of emaciated prisoners in the camp. Petra sings, and the guard is evil. He beats us every day.
sako gyves amen mare. Andre buti amen trade.
He chases us to work, and if he wants a woman, he keeps her behind, telling her to lie down. Petra, who has long dark hair and glasses, stares down at the ground.
It does take a lot to sing the song because I owe it to the song and to the history to really connect to the imagery. But I sang it a bunch of times and people would clap. I was so uncomfortable. So I always now say, please do not clap. This is not a performance. This is a testimony.
Wire fencing around the camp. In defiance of their captors, prisoners secretly make music for themselves.
Well, I was very grateful, as I am to this very day, for love of music. We had a little group, we just got together and we sang and we hummed. I used to whistle very well.
The camp is as large as the whole world to us. Be happy and rejoice, handsome Jewish worker. Soon this nightmare will be over.
In the block inside, we used to have groups. We sang together with Yiddish songs, Polish songs, any songs. Often Pripyat, Brenta
fire. In a fireplace, there is a little fire, and the house is hot. There sits a rabbi with his little children.
It gives us self-respect. You are somebody. You still didn't forget yourself. You're still retaining the Yiddish guy.
A white man in his 50s with a thick, graying beard, wavy light brown hair and glasses, Francesco Latoro, historian of Holocaust music. For over 30 years, Francesco has been tracking down and recording music from the Holocaust.
We cannot explain what happened in the camps with a logic. The war is a negation of logic. But gradually, day after day, week after week, year after year, in the camp, a great music literature was born.
A cannon explodes and a tank rolls through water. Francesco says, while the world was failing, musicians realized that they had the duty to save the civilization.
This music doesn't belong to the past. This music belongs to the future.
The actor playing Adam Kopaczynski.
In the face of death, and this is how we lived every day in the hell that was Auschwitz, why did so many people search for support in music? For a crushed man, overwhelmed by the struggle for everyday survival, he could find more in music than just temporary relief, but a clearer solution to many problems and a deeper sense of harmony to save and restore his nature. That was indeed a huge help, something which sometimes was a cure for prisoners' damaged psyche.
Francesco walks to an archive in a museum. Adam Kopaczynski wrote an original piece at Auschwitz. His handwritten manuscript still survives. Francesco puts on white gloves to handle the music. The author was the great Adam Kopaczynski. In 1941, he wrote this little Kołysanka, lullaby.
Lullaby. The dedication in Polish for the memories of nice discussions about home and our songs, I dedicated this lullaby to the lovely and nice Leon, with request for memory, Adam. The fact that it's a lullaby is surely dedicated to a child. No lyrics, it's just a piano solo music. And it's a very bright and optimistic piece.
He plays piano at night on the grounds of the Auschwitz Commandant's house. Kołysanka, Adam Kopaczynski. archive footage of a family walking through a train station, then on a platform, a woman grinning while cradling a baby in her arms. A sign on the side of the train reads, "Dresden, Hamburg, Altona." In the train carriage, the smiling woman holds up the happy baby. A man turns his toddler's face and kisses her cheek lightly. Soaring away from Francesco at the piano and across the dark grounds, Adam.
Speaking to prisoners, or prisoners getting themselves organised, wasn't allowed, but we could speak out. We had a voice and we could act, because music is a non-verbal and profound form of speech.
The word resistance surrounded by frantically scribbled overlapping musical notes. Heavy snow falling over the camp. Simon Lacks.
We had no vodka, so we sought forgetfulness in the music.
I had composed my own four-part piece for this group, which we rehearsed when conditions permitted.
Andre reads from his father's book called Music of Another World. Then he goes down to a basement.
Jewish music and Polish music was forbidden.
A door to a library.
So this piece had to be practiced in secret because it would have been considered as an act of resistance, and that was dangerous. What I think is that the piece that was performed at that time was a draft of what was to become the third quartet. You see that there is the title in French and in Polish, Third String Quartet, based on Polish popular tunes. This third quartet is entirely based on pretty well-known Polish tunes. It looks as a kind of national hymn, something to the glory of Poland. And it can be easily felt as a kind of assertion of Polishness.
By the camp, the quartet plays String Quartet No. 3, Second Movement by Simon Lacks. The sun shines over the camp behind them. Black and white footage of a man with a long beard doffing his cap, a man putting his arm around a grinning woman, a young woman taking off her hat with a smile, a woman waving then putting her arm around the woman beside her, then a happy-looking young boy giving one of the women a kiss on the cheek. A grinning couple with their arms around each other in a garden. The musicians play with serious looks on their faces.
One day we were playing in a strange concentration when suddenly a completely unknown SS man entered the room. We jumped up like one man. He asked, "What was that? Whose music is it?"
Simon laughs.
I could not say that I was the composer. In panic, I quickly raced through my memory and suddenly got the idea of mentioning an Austrian musician who isn't very well known. A very beautiful quartet. One could tell right away it was German music. And out he went.
Andrea Lacks.
I always thought that the Polish side of the third quartet really fit as an act of resistance against the annihilation of Poland and of Jewish music at the same time. So I interpreted it as an expression of we are there, here is our culture and we won't give it up.
The cellist shaking his fingers as they glide over the strings. More black and white footage of happy families waving and grinning at the camera, then lining up for photos. A little boy giving his younger brother a kiss, then a woman wrapping her arm around a man's shoulders while their child stands between them. An older woman waves, a woman tries to get a large dog to pose for a photo, then a woman in a black dress kisses another woman's cheek. Soaring away from the quartet and over the remaining buildings of the camp.
If this episode could be regarded as a sign of resistance, it's the only one I can boast of during my rather long stay at Birkenau. The rest was a struggle for survival.
An inky black mass of overlapping musical notes with the word hell in white amongst it. Gas chamber, Auschwitz 1.
Gas chambers were the principal agent of death, and their use was admirably organized. Prisoners were told to prepare themselves for a shower bath. They were even given towels to make them believe this story.
Canisters of Zyklon.
When the doors of the bathroom were closed behind them, poison gas, Zyklon, was released.
In her armchair, Anita smokes a cigarette.
The gas chamber was about as far away from me as... it was there. You could see it. You could see it. You could see the smoke. You could hear it. You could see the people walking in and coming out in smoke. And it was a matter of time when we are going to go in there. I mean, that was the thing. Are we still alive today? Well, tomorrow we may be in smoke.
A survivor.
When we found out what they do with the gas... Can you just imagine those people? Keep hearing the scratches.
Her eyes filled with tears, she shakes her head and holds her hands to her mouth. The long, empty gas chamber.
Being on the campsite where I was, one night we went to sleep and next to us there were 10,000 gypsies. The next day the campsite was empty.
Petra.
On the night between August 2nd and August 3rd of 1944, what remained of the entire gypsy family camp, those people were killed. They were put into the gas chambers. And that was the end of the camp. We thought it was maybe around 3,000. Now it's closer to 4,000 Roma and Sinti who were killed in that one night. And overall, there are several countries and over 80% of the Roma and or Sinti there were killed in the Holocaust.
scratches on the walls.
Auschwitz out there, he had a battle.
Lying beside Petra, a child is singing.
People ask me why I teach my kids Romani. It's a language that's definitely on the decline. It's very much an endangered language. But one of the major reasons is because it was supposed to be exterminated. The Nazis were trying to exterminate that whole culture. And for me, it's a form of resistance. And I think it's a way for me to honor all the people who didn't make it through the war, all the people who, you know, would have still been speaking Romani after the war and they couldn't.
Long grass swaying.
Cremation was the chief means of disposal of the great mass of body. Having been put to all this expense of murder, the Nazis were determined to make a profit. The charred remains were ground up and sold to German farmers as fertilizer.
Interviews with survivors.
I saw this huge, huge chimney. And I was standing there, mesmerized. I said, my God, these flames are reaching the heavens. And I didn't know what it was.
We see not so much flames, but smoke. Ah, now we know why the smell. It's a bakery. They were baking bread. Strange smell.
We were told that this building is a bakery, only it didn't smell like a bakery. We found out what it was. It took us a while to believe it. And the stench. Oh, the stench.
She raised her arm and said, do you see that cloud there? Do you smell the smell? And then she said, here are your relatives. Here they go. That's how we learned.
Smoke was so thick, burning, 10,000 human beings a day. The stench, 50 years later, you do not know what is lodged in my nostrils. Unbelievable, I can recall the stench of burning flesh from this distance. I not only can recall it, I cannot not recall it.
A watchtower by the perimeter fence on a misty day. The black mass covering Auschwitz on the map spreads wider and wider across Europe. Cannons fire from a ship in a harbor, then soldiers run over rubble and debris from collapsed buildings.
One of the strangest things about this whole period is that at the moment the Nazis are losing the war, in the summer of 1944, is actually when the Holocaust reaches its darkest phase. The Nazis bring in, on those trains, 430,000 Jews, the overwhelming majority of them murdered in Auschwitz. They reach a level of efficiency that they have not been able to match at any other time.
Gas chamber and crematorium two.
If you visit Auschwitz-Birkenau now, you just see rubble. That's because as the Nazis knew that the Russians were coming, they wanted to destroy the evidence. So these pictures do show the way the process worked. They show a train arriving. It's not a passenger train, it's a goods train. These would have been people from the Hungarian provinces, and there's a child being held by its mother. The whole process would happen extremely quickly. The people would have to be disembarked, their possessions taken from them and sorted for what the Nazis wanted to keep. Then they would have been corralled into columns, and the rest would be a job of herding those people in big numbers to the gas chambers. And as soon as one transport would come in and was cleared, a train would be arriving, bringing a new load. It was the height of German industrial efficiency, like you would see in an assembly line, except the product in this case were human corpses.
Thousands upon thousands of Hungarians poured into the camp. The death machinery was totally unable to cope with the influx. Gassing, murdering, and burning. The crematoria worked around the clock. In the end, people were thrown into the flames alive.
Even as they face defeat, the Nazis continue the exterminations. More Jews are transported to Auschwitz to be murdered on arrival. Songwriter Ilse Weber has spent the last 2 years imprisoned at Theresienstadt ghetto. The actor playing young Ilse is a slim white woman with dark hair in a bun. On the map, a line stretches west from Auschwitz to Theresienstadt in what was then Czechoslovakia. Ulrike.
In Theresienstadt, she made it her mission to set up a children's infirmary. She cared for her little patients during the day, and during her night watches, she made up lullabies to take them to a world of happiness, moments of happiness at least. And all the time, she was thinking of her son, Hanusz, their first son she had to send away. She saw him, little Hanusz, in all of the children.
A photo of Hanusz.
So when the children of Ilse's infirmary came on the transport list to Auschwitz, Ilse couldn't but sign up also. And so she accompanied the children together with her younger son, little Tommy, to Auschwitz.
A child's drawing.
When they came to Birkenau, they had to wait in front of the gas chamber where you could see a sign, disinfection. They were approached by a member of the Sonderkommando. That was a commando that had to pull the corpses from the gas chamber after the death of the people. A man that recognized Ilse from Theresienstadt. He gave her advice. Go as quickly as possible into the chamber. Sit with the children on the floor and start singing. Sing what you always sing with them. That way you will inhale the gas quicker. Otherwise, you would be trampled to death when panic breaks out.
Harrowing drawings of naked people piled together with looks of horror on their faces, fading in and out between images of the rubble.
This guardsman, he testified that when they were in this room, he heard her sing the lullaby, Vigala, so that the pain of dying for the children will be alleviated.
Twisted metal amongst the piles of shattered stone, then a drawing of a face with wide eyes and a gaping mouth. Vigala, Ilse Weber, a singer with dark hair, walks by what remains of the gas chamber.
Vigala, Vigala,
Beddy by Beddy by Byer, the wind plays on the lyre. He's playing sweetly in the reeds, the nightingale sings in the meads. Black and white images of women and young children sitting on the ground. Beddy by Beddy by Blantern, the moon, she is a lantern.
Er steht am Dunkel.
She looks from heaven's tent up high, a twinkle in her tired eye. Women and children wearing headscarves walking together along the long road by the fence of the camp. Beddy by Beddy by Blying, the world in stillness lying. No sound disturbs your peace and rest. Sleep, my baby, sleep in your nest.
Schlaf, mein Kindchen, schlaf auch du.
Beddy by Beddy by Blying. How is the world so quiet? Standing in the trees, the singer frowns, then closes her eyes and draws in a breath. She hangs her head. 27th of January 1945, 4 months after Ilse Weber and her son Tommy are killed, Auschwitz-Birkenau is liberated. A group of people in striped uniforms walk along the road by the fence. As the Allies reach camps across Europe, the scale of Nazi crimes becomes clear.
Death knells that drowned out their dead until the very day Allied armies broke through their gates. Now they were free. Most of them couldn't even walk or crawl.
A man on the ground.
Everywhere was the repeated, monotonous sight and stench of corpses. Shriveled bodies like old bones picked over by dogs. Piles and heaps like the litter of a boneyard.
The bodies was a mountain 2 stories high with dead people.
When you ever saw these mountains of bodies, you always saw somebody you knew. Best friend of mine, I saw.
Piles of naked dead bodies.
Nobody thought you'd get through the gate alive.
Black and white footage of a woman and a child walking past emaciated dead bodies.
You know, it is so disgraceful.
Yeah, what happened there?
Men carry a body on a wooden stretcher through the gates. Remember. Krzysztof Kuliszew, son of Alexander Kuliszew, is looking up at the trees in his garden.
My father, Alexander Kuliszew, after the war, he believed that his life is not his family, unfortunately. What was important for him was his mission, to show the people we were there in the camps and our friends died because they were murdered, and this is the music they wanted to give us. And I want to give it to you.
In his house.
Part of the music was a form of resistance, created to show that we are not cows, we are not sheep who say nothing, who cannot leave the testimony. It was resistance. And the message was, you should never surrender. Even if you are in hell, like they were in Nazi hell, even if you are not sure if you survive, if you see that other people die, you should not surrender. Never. My father was inspired by his great friend, Rosberry Dargutto, a Jewish
composer and choir director. Rosemary wanted to keep this information for the future. So he created the Jewish death song. He chose a Jewish folk song about brothers who were selling wine. And the number of these brothers was smaller and smaller. He wanted to show the people that the Jews, this was exactly what was happening. They were smaller and smaller. The number of Jews was becoming smaller and smaller.
Shadows on walls.
My father promised Darguto that he will do all his best to go around the world and to sing this song. And my father did it until the very end. He always told me, when the nation has its music, it has something, it has culture.
Rosemary Darguto is thought to have died on a transport to Auschwitz, but his Jewish death song survives. In a cemetery on a sunny day, a man with a thick beard and long wavy brown hair wearing a kippah approaches a monument to sing Jewish death song, lyrics by Rosemary Darguto.
Boom, 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 boom. Sein Brüder sind in mir gewesen.
We were 10 brothers, we traded in wine.
Einer ist gestorben.
One died, we were left with 9. Yedel with the fiddle, Moisha with the bass, sing a little song for me. We have to go into the gas.
Man führt uns in dem Gas, in dem Gas, in dem Gas.
Footage inside the gas chamber with stark bright lights and dark stone walls.
Boom, boom, boom. Ein Bruder nur ich bin geblieben.
I am the only brother left. With whom shall I now cry?
Soll ich weinen? Die andere hat mir.
The others have been murdered. Think of all 9. Footage of a stretcher being pushed into a furnace, then bones in a trough. Men twirling each other around, then a couple dancing while musicians play in the corner of the room. A couple share a kiss.
Sein Brüder sind in mir.
Footage of a man picking up bones from a huge pile of remains. The song continues. We were 10 brothers. We never hurt anyone. The man drops the small bones and scoops a pile of ashes into his hand. Then he walks away. Standing beside rows of gravestones, the singer furrows his brow deeply and lowers his gaze. In a dark corridor, piles of belongings displayed behind glass, one with thousands of shoes. 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. Flying over long buildings in neat rows on the camp.
The headline account of the loss of the Holocaust that we give is that figure of 6 million. But in a way, it doesn't convey the full depth of the tragedy, because there was a whole world that has all but vanished. There was a language, Yiddish. There was a civilization and a culture. There were books written. There were forms of music, forms of religious study, costume, humor. Herded into those gas chambers were poets and writers and artists, and who knows what those people would have done. And then when you look at these photographs and you see that baby, you think of not just that life, but there was also the potential, the future generations that went with them. Because every one of those people did not have a child or a grandchild or a great-grandchild. And when Jews mourn the Holocaust, I think that is partly what they mourn, is not just the lives, but the world that was lost.
Footage of people with their arms around each other dancing in concentric circles. Anita.
I'm just appalled what we are going through now again with senseless, stupid anti-Semitism. And how badly everybody is behaving. So what have we learned?
The singer with the bushy beard by the monument. Since the war, Ilse Weber's songs have been rediscovered and performed again. Composer Simon Lax returned to Paris in 1945. His music was haunted by memories of Auschwitz. Adam Kopaczynski became founder conductor of the Wrocław Philharmonic Orchestra in Poland. Anita Lasker settled in London, where she became a founder member of the English Chamber Orchestra. She married fellow refugee and concert pianist Peter Wolfish. Together, they began a celebrated musical dynasty.